There was only one thing left to do for it. That very same night, I booked another $175,000 private jet and flew right back to Switzerland. I need you to combine my morning and evening dose. Ich verche kein Englisch, the Swiss nurse said. This was going to be a problem. My pressing need to change the rules versus her lack of English. This was all done in some weird German-English game of charades. I don't need a pill at 6 o'clock in the morning. I need it when it's scary, at night. I can't find the center of the fear. It's general. Also, I can't sleep. So there's a negotiation every single night with myself. My mind races. The ideas come so fast. I get auditory hallucinations, too. I hear voices and conversations, and sometimes I even talk back. Sometimes, too, I'll think that somebody wants to hand me something, and I put my hand out to get that nothing from no one. Sober or not, this troubled me a bit. On top of everything else, I'm crazy? It's not schizophrenia, just a damn load of voices. The voices, I'm told, do not make me a crazy person. They're called auditory hallucinations, and they happen to people all the time. There is no cure for the voices. Of course there isn't. Actually, I can think of a cure. It's called being somebody else. Either way, I needed those pills as one shot at night without saving any for the morning. Morning, evening, together, I said, miming 8 pills in my hand, not one. Nie kein Atnug, she said. Tomorrow morning, no pill, now instead, I said extremely slowly. Ich habe kein Atnug, was sehr brauchen. You and everybody else, no one knows what I need. Back in L.A. one more time, trying to sober up, I think, wait, how did I get engaged? There are dogs living in my house. How did this happen? I asked her parents, begged for her hand while high, and put up with the dogs. That's how scared I was of being abandoned. Chapter 4, Like I've Been There Before. It was so special it felt like we'd all been together in a previous life or something, or in a future life, but certainly this one. This was a real day, but a day that dreams were made of. For the longest time, I didn't really want to talk too much about friends. Partly that was because I'd done plenty of other stuff too. But all anybody ever wanted to talk about was Chandler. It's like James Taylor talking about Fire and Rain, a gruesome little tale if you've ever heard what that's about. It's like a band who've written a brilliant new album, but all anyone wants to hear when they play live is the hits. I always admired Kurt Cobain's refusal to play Smells Like Teen Spirit, or Led Zeppelin's refusal to play Stairway to Heaven. The New York Times once said, friends sticks to Perry like a sweaty shirt. They weren't right about that. In fact, it's just fucking cruel. But they weren't the only ones to think it. I was so good at something, yet I was being penalized for it. I left my blood, sweat, and tears on stage every Friday night. We all did. And that should be a good thing, not something that says we can only excel at that. I'm not complaining. If you're going to be typecast, that's the way to do it. But in recent years, I've come to understand just what friends means to people. And we knew from the very start that it was something very, very special. I was the last actor to be cast in the entire pilot season of 1994. In fact, I got the gig on the actual final day of pilot season. With LAX 2194 thankfully in the rearview mirror, I was free to be Chandler Bing. The following Monday after the Friday I was hired was day one of my new life. This was big. And I guess we all felt that way, because we all showed up dead on time. Well, Matt LeBlanc was first every single day, Aniston last every single day. The cars got nicer, but the order stayed the same. We sat around the table and all met each other for the first time. That is, except for me and Jennifer Aniston. Jennifer and I had met through mutual acquaintances about 3 years earlier. I was immediately taken by her. How could I not be? And I liked her. And I got the sense that she was intrigued too. Maybe it was going to be something. Back then, I got 2 jobs in 1 day. One was Haywire, an America's Funniest Home Videos type show, and the other was a sitcom. So I called Jennifer and I said, "You're the first person I wanted to tell this to." Bad idea. I could feel ice forming through the phone. Looking back, it was clear that this made her think that I liked her too much, or in the wrong kind of way. And I only compounded the error by then asking her out. She declined, which made it very difficult to actually go out with her, but said that she'd love to be friends with me. And I compounded the compound by blurting, "We can't be friends." Now, a few years later, ironically, we were friends. Fortunately, even though I was still attracted to her, I thought she was so great. That first day, we were able to sail right past that past and focus on the fact that we had both gotten the best jobs Hollywood had to offer. Everyone else was brand new to me. Courtney Cox was wearing a yellow dress and was cripplingly beautiful. I had heard about Lisa Kudrow from a mutual friend, and she was just as gorgeous and hilarious and incredibly smart as my friend had said. Matty LeBlanc was nice and a cool customer, and David Schwimmer had had his hair cut really short. He had been playing Pontius Pilate for his theater troupe in Chicago, over his hangdog face, and was incredibly funny right away. Warm and smart and creative. After me, he was the guy who pitched the most jokes. I probably pitched 10 jokes a day, and 2 of them got in. They weren't just jokes for me. I'd pitch jokes for everybody. I'd go up to Lisa and say, "You know, it might be funny if you tried to say this," and she'd try it. The director, Jimmy Burrows, was the best in the business, too. He directed both Taxi and Cheers. He knew instinctually that job one was for us to get to know each other and generate chemistry. Immediately, there was electricity in the air. I'd always wanted to be the only funny one. But now, at the ripe old age of 24, I quickly realized that it's better if everyone is funny. I could already tell this was going to be big. I knew it from the start, but didn't say anything out loud. Partly that was because it isn't unheard of for an actor to fuck up a table read so badly that they were politely asked to leave before a minute of shooting took place. But that would be tomorrow. For now, Jimmy took the 6 of us to Monica's apartment set and told us just to talk to each other. And so we did. We talked and joked about romance, our careers, our loves, our losses. And the bond that Jimmy knew would be critical had begun. The 6 of us ate lunch together outside on a beautiful spring day. As we ate, Courtney, the only established name of the group back then, said, "There are no stars here. This is an ensemble show. We're all supposed to be friends." Given her status, she'd been on Family Ties and in Ace Ventura and a guest spot on Seinfeld and had danced with Bruce Springsteen in the video for Dancing in the Dark. She could have been everything and everybody. She could easily have said, "I'm the star." Hell, she could have had her lunch somewhere else. And we would have to be fine with it. Instead, she simply said, "Let's really work and get to know each other." She said it's what she noticed about how it worked on Seinfeld, and she wanted it to be true about Friends, too. So, we did what she suggested. From that first morning, we were inseparable. We ate every meal together, played poker. At the start, I was a full-on joke man, cracking gags like a comedy machine whenever I could, probably to the annoyance of everyone, trying to get everybody to like me because of how funny I was. Because why else would anybody like me? It would take 15 years for me to learn that I didn't need to be a joke machine. That first afternoon, we were assigned dressing rooms, which eventually didn't matter because we were never in them. We were always together. As we walked to our cars and said goodbye that first evening, I remember thinking, "I'm happy." This was not an emotion I was altogether used to. That night, I called my friends, except for Craig Bierko, given what had happened, and told them what a wonderful day I'd had. I then spent yet another night at college, the Formosa, as was my custom. I remember saying that night that I was on a show that was so good it was better than anything I could have dreamed of writing myself. My friends were all so happy for me. But even then, I could sense a shift. Maybe I was growing out of this Formosa thing. I had a life-changing job that I had to, hell, I desperately wanted to report to in the morning. So I drank far less than usual. My apartment even had a life cycle in the back, and I used it every day, dropping about 10 pounds of baby alcohol fat between the pilot and the first episode. That night, I went to bed thinking, I can't wait to go back there tomorrow. Next morning, as I drove from Sunset and Doheny over the Cahuenga Pass to the Warner Brothers lot in Burbank, I realized that I was leaning towards the windshield as I drove. I wanted to be there. That would be true for the next decade. Day two was big. We reported to a new building, Building 40, for our first table read. I was nervous and excited, and yet confident too. I was always good at table reads, but there was still the looming thought that anyone could be fired and replaced. Lisa Kudrow, for example, had originally been cast as Roz on Frasier, but had been fired during the rehearsal process by none other than Friends director Jimmy Burrows. If jokes didn't land or something was off, well, anybody could be replaced before they even properly found their way to their dressing room. But I knew Chandler. I could shake hands with Chandler. I was him. And I looked a lot like him, too. That day, the room was packed. In fact, it was standing room only. There were writers, executives, network people. There must have been 100 people in the room. But I was a song and dance man, and this is where I excelled. We got reacquainted with Marta Kaufman, David Crane, and Kevin Bright, the people behind the show who had hired us, and almost instantly we all felt they were our parental figures. Before the table read began, we all went around the room introducing ourselves and saying what we did for the show. Then it was time to read. How would it go? Would the chemistry we'd only just started to create show up? Or were we just six young hopefuls making believe that this would be our big break? We needn't have worried. We were ready. The universe was ready. We were pros. The lines flew out of our mouths. No one made a mistake. All the jokes landed. We finished to thunderous applause. Everyone could smell money. The cast could smell fame. After the read, the six of us piled into a van and were brought to the actual set at stage 24 to begin rehearsing. But it was the run-through at the end of the day that sealed the deal. The jokes, the chemistry, the script, the direction, everything was magical. All the elements seemed to meld into one hilarious, cogent, powerful whole. And we all knew it. This show was going to work. And it was going to change everyone's lives forever. I swear there was a popping sound. If you listened really closely, you could hear it. It was the sound of people's dreams coming true. It was everything I thought I wanted. I was going to fill all the holes with friends like us. Fuck Charlie Sheen. I was going to be so famous that all the pain I carried with me would melt like frost in the sunlight. And any new threats would bounce off me as though this was a force field I could cloak myself in. There is an unwritten law in show business that to be funny, you had to either look funny or be older. But here we were, six attractive people, all in their 20s, all knocking every joke out of the park. That evening, I drove home on a cloud. There was no traffic, all the lights were green. A trip that should have taken a half an hour took 15 minutes. The attention that I always felt had eluded me was about to fill every corner of my life, like a room illuminated by a flash of lightning. People were going to like me now. I was going to be enough. I mattered. I wasn't too needy. I was a star. Nothing was going to stop us now. No one walking into a ballroom would have to turn around and notice me. All eyes would be on me now, not the pretty woman walking 3 feet in front of me. We rehearsed the rest of the week, and it was then that we began to notice something else. I've been an actor since 1985, and that has never happened before or since, and it was beautiful. The bosses were not in the least tyrannical. In fact, it was a truly creative atmosphere. We could pitch jokes, and the best joke won, no matter where it came from. The craft service lady said something funny, put it in. It didn't matter. So not only was I there as an actor, but my creative juices were flowing too. The creators took each of us out for lunch to get to know us, so they could incorporate some aspects of our real personalities into the show. At my lunch, I said two things. One, that even though I considered myself not unattractive, I had terrible luck with women, and that my relationships tended towards the disastrous. And two, that I was not comfortable in any silence at all. I have to break any such moment with a joke. And this became a built-in excuse for Chandler Bing to be funny, perfect for a sitcom. And Chandler wasn't much good with women either, as he shouts at Janice as she leaves his apartment, "I've scared you. I've said too much. I'm awkward and hopeless and desperate for love." But think of a better character for a sitcom. Someone who is uncomfortable in silence and has to break the silence with a joke. This was all too true, both for Chandler and for me. Fairly early in the making of Friends, I realized that I was still crushing badly on Jennifer Aniston. Our hellos and goodbyes became awkward, and then I'd ask myself, how long can I look at her? Is 3 seconds too long? But that shadow disappeared in the hot glow of the show. That and her deafening lack of interest. On tape nights, nobody made a mistake. We might have run scenes over if a joke didn't land. All the writers would huddle together and rewrite, but mistakes just never happened. So many shows have blooper reels, but there are only a few for Friends. From the pilot on, in fact, that pilot was error-free. We were the New York Yankees, slick, professional, top of our game from the very start. We were ready. And I was talking in a way that no one had talked in sitcoms before, hitting odd emphases, picking a word in a sentence you might not imagine was the beat, utilizing the Murray Perry cadence. I didn't know it yet, but my way of speaking would filter into the culture across the next few decades. For now, though, I was just trying to find interesting ways into lines that were already funny, but that I thought I could truly make dance. Marta Kauffman was later to say that writers would underline the word not usually emphasized in a sentence just to see what I would do with it. Even when there were issues with the characters, we were able to work them out to the point where the solutions created their own iconic moments. When I first read the script, I knew it was different because it was so character-driven and smart. But early on, Matt LeBlanc was concerned that because he was this kind of cool, macho ladies' man in the script, Rachel, Monica, and Phoebe wouldn't be friends with him, wouldn't like him that much. And that made his character less believable. It didn't help that Matt was very good-looking. He had leading man looks, even to the point where I was a little jealous of that when I first saw him. But he was so nice and funny that any jealousy I had disappeared. But still, he hadn't been able to find the right way into his character. He was the one character in the show that had not been properly defined. He was described as a cool Pacino type, out-of-work actor, so that's how he played it. But it still wasn't working. At one point during a wardrobe session, he put on brown leather pants, which were thankfully nixed by everyone, especially Marta, who was in charge. Then came the moment early in the run where he has an exchange with Courtney about a woman he's been seeing and how the sex wasn't working out. Courtney asks him if he thought of being there for the girl, and Joey just simply didn't understand that concept. That was the moment he turned from being a ladies' man to a lovable, useless, dumb puppy. He underlined this by doing a running joke of things being repeated to him and him not following them. He had found his position in the show, which was basically as a big dumb brother to Rachel, Monica, and Phoebe. Everyone was in place. Occasionally, Matt would come into my dressing room, mostly during season one, and ask me how to say his lines, and I would tell him.